Hi everybody, I'm Billy Harlan, and this is Antioch, Chapter 25, Burying Saints. Andolin and Margot were gossiping in the kitchen and packing picnic baskets with leftover fried chicken and jars of pickled apples. It was convenient for Michael that his acolyte lived at the cauldron. She always brought plenty of good food when she came to practice. Andolin said, "Faith comes to see him almost every day, and brings a pie." She had that small, self-satisfied smile that comes from understanding someone else's motives. Margot clucked and shimmied. "Sounds to me like she's courting him." "Is that how it is done? With pie?"
"Well, you've got to let the great Bulgars know somehow, don't you? But I knew better than to bake a pie for Fergus."
"Does he dislike it?"
"No, he makes a wicked apple. Ooh, no good to make him something he'd make better for himself. I gave him a stout cask of the family recipe instead. That got his attention."
An intelligent maneuver.
"It was love at first pint."
They shared a laugh. Then Margot gestured at Andolin's left hand.
"Biggs has put a pretty little fellow on your finger, hasn't he? Is that how it's done overseas?"
Andolin admired the ring for a moment. "Yes, though it is unusual to receive the royal seal of an Antithian dynasty as an engagement ring."
"That's posh."
"I do not believe he knew the value of what he was offering me." Biggs snuck into the kitchen while she was speaking and stood behind her. He wore a heavy fur coat and a big furry hat. Margot smiled at him.
"Oh, I don't know. He seems pretty sure of himself."
He said,
"That's right. It's a old family heirloom, 'cause I'm something of a highfalutin Tithonine."
He gave Andolin a peck on the cheek.
"Ornum, one of these for me?"
He motioned at the baskets. Andolin could not have imagined many of the things that had come to pass over the last year and a half, not even in the darkest of her nightmares. Out of them all, her packing a picnic basket to send a red-necked husband off to work seemed among the most absurd. Embracing the ridiculousness of it, she said,
"Yes, this one. Have a good day, dear."
Biggs paused. Then he smiled and looked around the medieval kitchen like he was seeing it for the first time, despite having slept upstairs for months. He scratched his head and said,
"Did you just say that?"
She blurted out,
"I did!"
and surrendered to laughter. Biggs understood right away and laughed with her. Margot smiled at the pair of them and continued packing. They made a fine match, in her opinion. Biggs kissed Andolin again, on the mouth that time, with his hand on the back of her head to make it count. She was grinning when he pulled away. Her life was absurd, but it was not altogether unpleasant. Her gallant cowboy slung his rifle over his shoulder, headed for the door, and said,
"You have yourself a good day too now, darling."
He opened it to the outside, a gust of cold and swirling snow, and then he jumped back against the stove.
"Ugh!"
Andolin and Margot started when he called out. Biggs stomped his foot.
"Dad, come at Mervis, quit creeping around!"
From outside.
"Okay."
The three humans shook their heads with relief and waved goodbyes. Biggs left for his perch at the wall. Marabas poked in through the doorway, hairy face caked with blood and ice. He stared at the other picnic basket.
"That's fried chicken."
Margot waved a finger at him and moved to prevent him from entering.
"Marabas! Don't you even think about it. Ooh, filthy beast, get off to the well!"
She couldn't stand him tramping all about and making a bloody mess inside, even if he had brought a carcass to Fergus. Marabas spent a moment wondering if he could stop thinking about something at will. Then the scent wafting from the basket refocused him.
"I want it."
Margot put her fists on her hips.
"Well, that's too bad then, isn't it? Because you can't have it. That's for Michael and Harold. Now get!"
Marabas' face fell, as though he'd been delivered the most horrible news. Andolin took pity on him. "It is all right, Margot. He may have a piece. Here, boss." She tossed him a thigh. She had taken to calling him boss in part because it reminded her of Sergeant Sebastian. Unfortunately, the nickname tended to give Marabas pause, and the chicken hit him in the face. Then it fell on the ground. Andolin's hand went to her mouth. Margot said, "Ooh!" and started laughing. Marabas saw what had struck him, snatched it up off the floor, and devoured it. Margot covered her laughter with one hand and shooed the gunder with the other.
"Go wash up at the well, ooh, before you come in, ooh!"
Marabas bounded away. Margot turned to laugh with Andolin, whose head was bowed from doing so. It was a good start to the day. The morning sun sparkled on the distant rooftops. Snow crested the tombstones and crunched under Andolin's boots. Walking through the graveyard always gave her goose flesh. She took the same path every time, the one they had that awful night, because it was the most direct. The hollow under her black scarf ached from the cold and from the memory. When she arrived at the church, a woman had just closed the door to leave, bundled against the weather in humble brown and white. Andolin rounded the bell and said,
"Good morning, Faith."
Faith shrieked in terror. and backed into the wall, clutching her chest. Andolin stood there with a picnic basket, sorry to have caused such a fright, and decided to make her presence known from farther away next time. Michael burst out, fully armored except for one hand, which held a messy piece of gooseberry pie. After looking them over and realizing everyone was safe, he said, "God's mercy! I thought the Balron had come back." It had been more than a month since one had answered his bell, 2 weeks since the last infection. Faith breathed into her hands, embarrassed.
"Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, Andolin, I'm sorry. How silly of me. You must think me such a cowardly ninny."
Fear released her like a clawed grip, leaving pins and needles behind. Andolin said, "I do not," and stepped forward. "This is a frightening place. You are courageous to come here as often as you do." Faith managed a sheepish smile. Her face hadn't suffered jagged cuts like Andolin's. Faith could hide most of her wounds under her clothes. However, Michael had realigned a few of her broken bones, having broken them again by hand to do so, and ridges from some of those second fusions showed beneath the skin of her cheek. Andolin saw a rugged beauty in the damage, evidence of what had been survived. It was easier to appreciate in someone else. Michael nodded, respecting what Andolin had said.
"Ah, quite right. And you visit me without any sort of want or need. That's not only brave, but selfless. Good show, Faith."
Faith became even more embarrassed than she'd been before. She curtsied to excuse herself and scuttled away, picking an awkward path home through the frozen graves. Michael stared after her for a moment. Then he held the door open and said, "It's the candle again today." Andolin nodded and went in. The contents of the library cluttered the church. Michael had emptied that back room out to make a prison cell for Harold. The round table took up the space of 3 sleeping mats. Books piled from floor to waist in seemingly random columns around the hall. Scrolls and loose papers crowded the corners along with iron-bound chests and a few hardwood practice swords, carved to the measure of Callaghan's. Harold's shield, emblazoned with a scarlet wolf's head, leaned against the wall, his broadsword behind it. His plate mail suit sat on the stones like an empty metal man, and Harold himself sat on a stack of displaced mats near the hearth. Gaunt in his donated clothing, he didn't look up when they came in. Andolin said, "I want you to eat today, Harold. I have something excellent in this basket." Harold was a soldier who'd lost everything but his honor. "No, thank you." He'd taken nothing but water since he'd survived, and he rarely spoke unless it was to politely refuse the kindness of his jailer. Michael hadn't kept him locked up for very long. Harold didn't seem like he would try to escape. He'd even given his word that he wouldn't when Michael asked him for it. There was nowhere for him to go anyway, and it had grown too cold to keep him in the back room. Andolin and Michael shared a look of concern, but Harold was in no immediate danger from his self-imposed fast. So Michael lit a candle from the fireplace and sat down at the round table with the rest of Faith's pie. Andolin prepared a quick plate of chicken and pickled apples and set it on the floor next to Harold, who slumped when he saw it. Michael said to her, "Let's see how much you can do by yourself first." She rolled up her sleeve and took a seat in front of the candle. She'd earned a hairless patch on her forearm from this exercise. Harold turned to watch. Andolin sat in calm concentration, her first goal being to achieve that feeling of nothingness. She did so by remembering the faces of unfortunate sailors like Sue, Fritz, and Drake. Andolin had discovered by then what her path truly was. It was the void she needed to feel in order to pull the trigger. The nothingness was a suppression of emotion. But in that way, it was also part of the realm of ideas and of feelings and of the will, and so was subject to the circle's techniques. She was improving. It took her less than a minute to follow the nothingness to its source, where it was a perversion of Rin, that strange, limitless influence that inexplicably enters reality to cause life. She had learned to perceive these things outside of her other senses, and was able to pull at the source with her will, widening it just barely more than its natural gauge. Thus, she opened the way, slightly. Additional Rin flickered into her body, like tongues of ghostly fire. Success. She held her arm up to the heat, close enough to burn, and Rin coursed toward the damage on its own. It was an exhilarating sensation, like a champion had taken the field for her, certain of victory. She couldn't release the sheer amount of power that Michael could, though, and held her arm too close. It started to hurt. She lost focus, hissed, and withdrew. Michael said, "You're doing it again. Don't try to defeat the candle. You'll only damage yourself that way. This exercise is about growing accustomed to Rin's ebb and flow. Hold your arm only close enough to feel that." She nodded and readied herself for another try, but definitely harbored intent to defeat the candle. Andolin channeled steadily against the flame for a minute at a time, a rivaling glow under her skin. Michael sometimes put his hand on her forehead and observed her reflection while she did. Now and then he would use his more advanced technique to pull a comparably tremendous amount of Rin into her body, thereby helping to reveal to her the invisible locks and tumblers that allowed for such access. With his assistance, she could hold her arm directly over the flame, and Rin flared into the world from her with blinding radiance. They practiced like that for 2 hours, while Harold sat in silent amazement. Then they took a break, ate, and discussed what they'd done, and how she could improve. And they noticed Harold eating as well. The three shared solemn smiles. Harold's curiosity had finally overcome his willful depression. He was filled with questions. In becoming open to ask them, he also became open to a meal. Harold said, "You were right. This is excellent. Thank you." Andolin was glad to see him coming around. "You are welcome." Michael held up a drumstick. "Fried chicken is my favorite. I think it's even better when it's cold. Would you care to try some of this gooseberry pie? It's also quite good." He offered the dish. Harold accepted it. "Yes, I would. Thank you." Though his first bite in weeks let hunger rage into him like an animal, Harold kept a ceremonious and reserved manner when eating. King's men were not barbarians to scarf their food. He consistently invalidated Michael's preconceptions. Harold said, "May I ask some questions about what it is that you're doing?" Michael said, "Certainly." "Thank you. Can anyone do that?"
"Yes."
"There's no part of ancestry to it?"
Michael prickled some. "As there is with royal entitlement? No, certainly not."
Harold proceeded cautiously. "Why are there so few of you who possess this ability? How can I have never heard of this skill before?"
"That is a long story about my order's ignorance, secrets, and misguided loyalty. Suffice it to say, the plague forced us to correct that, and hopefully not too late."
Harold nodded. "With just a few more of you, the entire kingdom could have survived."
"I don't say that to cast blame. I can tell you're acting in the right. It's just such an overwhelming tragedy."
They waited for him to speak again while he picked up a book and turned through it. Harold had been educated at the Royal Academy and was fond of reading, but the Circle's library confounded him. Not one of the books was written in Meroan. Some contained drawings of wicked-looking beasts and demons.
"What are these about? I've never seen such symbols."
Michael said, "Much of this is bestiary. It is a collection of devils and how to deal with them." With a mixture of sadness and interest, Harold said,
"Do you have one for the Balrog?"
"I do. I wrote it." It was the second book Michael had written for the church. The first hadn't been very useful. He stood up, went straight across the room, and retrieved the original Book of Balrog from one of the piles. He handed it over, curious to hear more of what had been on Harold's mind for the past 2 weeks. Harold weighed it in hand, guessing it was the most valuable book in the world. It was an inch thick, bound in leather, and encoded with a solid volume of vital information.
"You knew right where this one was."
"I know where all of them are. I've read and reread this entire collection since the plague began, searching for some record of the man named Ezekiel, the one who guided the sailors here." Andolin did not know Michael had been researching Zeke. It roused her interest. Harold said,
"And you found nothing?"
"Not much more than the loose notes in that book." Andolin said, "May I see those?" Harold handed them up. It almost gave her a twinge of seasickness to unfold the one from the Grace. She could not read it. Learning the script was not a prudent use of their time, but she knew what it said. "Armageddon is arrived. Break your silence. Open the library." She said, "Is it possible that he contributed to any of these volumes without leaving his name? Would you recognize his handwriting?" Michael said, "He does have a peculiar hand. There's a sweeping, artistic quality to his style. The only place I've found its like is where he signed the ledger of ordination." Andolin said, "May I see that?" Michael went 3 piles over, lifted 4 books from the top, and placed them on the floor next to the others to preserve whatever bizarre order he had them in. Then he brought the ledger to Andolin and flipped right to Ezekiel's signature. "For most of us, this is the first time we ever used the script, in signing our names to this book. Look at how clumsy the others are, but not his. It's an obvious match."
"Yes, even I can tell. Look at how much of the page he uses compared to everyone else. That is an arrogant signature by any standard.
What does it say here, around it?"
"Those are the dates of his ordination, and his supposed death, where he was from, and where he's buried in the churchyard."
Andolin was surprised. "Ezekiel has a marker outside."
"Yes, I've visited it. I'm sure I've told you."
She raised an eyebrow. "You have not. That is interesting.
I wonder who is buried there.
Michael shrugged. I suppose we'll never know.
Harold said. Where was he from?
Moreau. Harold darkened. Despite his previous withdrawal, they had explained much to him already. The loss of Moreau, believed by some scholars to be the birthplace of civilization, was what had convinced him there was no hope for the kingdom. He knew the smoke had bridged the gap and had gone on to destroy everything.
Andelin said, That grave makes Zeke a liar.
Michael said, Maybe.
How else can you explain the marker?
I don't know.
A man calling himself by the name on a tombstone is concealing something, possibly a murder, or it might even be evidence of a conspiracy.
Now I'm beyond interested.
Michael sighed. Honestly, a murder? Ezekiel saved your lives.
Andelin smirked.
Very well. If he is who he says he is, then no one else is buried there. So, what is?
What? Was that a question?
Exhume what is there. Find out.
Michael's chin pulled into his throat.
God's mercy, what an awful suggestion. Why would I do something dreadful like that?
She chuckled at him. Out of curiosity, for the sake of inquisition, as a way to spend your time.
You have read and reread your library looking for him. That is no light endeavor. There is a stone outside with his name on it. Look for him there.
Michael remembered having had a similar conversation with her before.
Desecrating the grave of a saint. It's a mortal sin.
And not only that, thou shalt not defile the dead.
In Moreau, Andelin had been wary of Michael having strong religious beliefs, knowing how dangerous such things often are. Since then, she had come to see such ideals as a loose kind of innocence in him, rather than a threatening dictator of behavior, and she was comfortable speaking freely with him on the subject. Who is left to punish you for your sins, Michael?
He frowned at her.
That is not the point. Regardless, Ezekiel's grave became an earthen hole in the snow. In it up to his hips, Michael heaved out dirt with a shovel. Andelin and Harold stood watching nearby with their breath curling in the air. They'd been going in and out of the church for warmth since Michael had started.
Harold rubbed his arms.
I can't believe he isn't exhausted yet. He's been at it forever.
Andelin said.
Michael is able to draw considerable stamina from the way.
If only I could. Is there a place in town we can get a cup of coffee?
Andelin smiled.
Yes, I would like that.
However, I should warn you, since you are staying with him, the mention of coffee tends to sour Michael's mood.
Harold understood.
Noted. Andelin called out that she and Harold were leaving. Michael waved for them to go ahead, not concerned at all. Once he'd decided to unearth Ezekiel's mysterious remains, he could think of nothing else. The other two had been gone for half an hour when his shovel struck masonry. Michael scraped at it and then stood back for a moment. Saints weren't buried in stone. Unless the ways had changed, it should have been a coffin made of pine, and it should have rotted away long ago. Even the caligan and sleeve would have been nothing more than rust after 200 years in the ground. He returned to digging and scraping, searching for the edges of what he'd found. Andelin and Harold returned 2 hours later, after one of those long talks over coffee that so often turns compatible personalities into thick companions. They were still in lively discourse when they approached Ezekiel's marker. Harold chuckled at her.
You're a disturbing person.
Andelin smirked.
Do you think so? I consider myself a free spirit.
It seemed from a distance that Michael was no longer there. He could not be so deep in the hole that none of him showed. Andelin wondered if they had lost track of time, and if he was already back in the church. As they got closer, the goose flesh started to rise. At 50 yards, she shouted, Michael! There was no answer. She stopped and looked around, feeling exposed.
Harold said, Is something wrong?
I should not have called out.
He's most likely back inside, wouldn't you say?
Andelin's jaw clenched, and she nodded. Harold rubbed his arms from the cold.
Perhaps we should go inside as well.
So they did, and Michael wasn't there. Andelin drew her pistol and pointed it at the door. They were in danger. She knew it. Overreaction was impossible. If Michael was not at the church, everyone was in danger. And if a Bowron walked through that door, it could kill both of them. She said, Stay here. Lock yourself in the library.
Harold said, Not likely, and grabbed up his broadsword and shield.
Andelin ran outside with Harold on her heels. They were far away from the church before she stopped, far away from anything concealing. She would not let one surprise her around a corner. She said, They do not make any sound. They just come. You have to watch every second, everywhere around you.
Harold followed her lead, keeping his eyes open.
Andlin could think of no other explanation. Michael must have answered a signal bell. They would have heard the Walls bell from Bethaford's. She had before. The Eastern bell was even closer. But she might not have heard the Western or the Southern. And the Southern bell was the most ominous of them all. That would be the one that rang when the remnants of Moreau and Breog and every other settlement sacrificed south of the Circle's Arc finally marched on Antioch. And when that army of the dead came, it would be old. Andelin remembered Ditch saying,
"I hate the fast ones, man. They're like spiders or something, you know? Hard to hit."
It was accurate. She hated to think of them. But no, she had not heard the church bell. Michael would have rung out with that before answering any of the others. Out of frustration, she shouted, "Michael!" No answer. "Michael!" No answer. It was infuriating. Every time she called for him, she told the Bowron where she was. Harold said, "Let's check the marker again, just to be sure." They ran to it. As they got closer, what seemed to be a second headstone was jutting up out of the excavation. It was actually a massive 400-pound slab, tilted up out of that hole like a lid. Its cold gray seat, streaked with earth, framed a rectangular pit in the foot of the grave. They couldn't see the bottom. Andelin yelled into it, "Michael!" and jerked to look around, still expecting silent stalkers at any moment. So haunted for her was the churchyard's white desolation. Her heart beat like a bird's wings in her chest. Harold peered into the darkness.
"My goodness, he must be down there."
"Michael!"
Before she could call a third time, Michael's face appeared in the light of a candle 25 feet down.
"I'm here. Is everything all right?"
His voice was faint and far away. Aftershocks of anger and fear rippled through Andelin's body. She could only walk through the graveyard in the mornings because she knew Michael was in the church. When she didn't know where he was, there was no more terrifying place in the world. She put a trembling hand over her face and said through gritted teeth,
"Yes, everything is fine."
Michael called up again.
"What? There's a ladder. Come see what I've discovered."
Andelin shoved her revolver into its holster. She would not yell up and down the depth of that hole with him. She would go down there and tell him exactly how irresponsible it was for him to be out of earshot for so long. Her boots clanked on the wrought iron ladder as she descended. Harold followed, his shield on his back. She harangued Michael as she went.
"You cannot hear anything down here, Michael. We have been calling for you. What if there had been an emergency?"
He waited for them with his candle, disappointed in himself.
"Ah, quite right, of course. I must have lost track of time. Has something happened?"
She reached the floor and dusted her hands, snapping her words at him.
"No, fortunately. What is this, a burial chamber?"
The air did not move at all down there, and tasted stale and dry. What they said stayed alive in a sepulchral echo. Michael said, "I found this," and handed her a very old book. She opened it, thinking, "Wonderful, more sacred script. I cannot read this. What is it?" Ezekiel's hand. She held it up and re-examined the telling strokes. Then, as her vision adjusted, she saw shapes over Michael's shoulder. He moved toward them, revealing rows upon rows of ancient bookcases. Flat columns filled with literature from the stone floor to the stone ceiling planed into the darkness of a room that neither the depth nor the width of which could she determine by the candle's light. Michael said, "Every one of them so far, see?" He took down another tome at random and brought it to her. Therein was Ezekiel's hand. Harold whistled. Andelin's mouth fell open.
"Unprecedented. What kind of information do they contain?"
Michael gestured helplessly at the shelves.
"Where should I start? There must be thousands of them. That first one I gave you is page after page of the emotional impact an apple had on him, as far as I can tell."
Andelin squinted at him. "An apple?" Michael nodded, like Ezekiel must have been insane. "It is explicit, to say the least." Harold said, "It must have been some apple." Michael looked sideways at him, and then turned back to the books.
"I might have to read a few of these just to put them in some sort of context. I've no idea how they're organized."
They stood in speechless appraisal of the discovery. Michael carefully replaced the books, and then took down another. Opening it and skimming a page, he feared he could devote every day of his life to reading, from sunrise to sunset, and never finish what Ezekiel's tomb contained. Michael said,
"I think this is the library. When he told us to open the library, I think this is what he meant. And I'm the only one who can read it."
Andelin had seen enough.
Collect a few of them for investigation. We are deaf in this hole.
Michael agreed, and picked the first five off the top shelf farthest to his left, hoping that was where they started. As they climbed out, Harold offered,
If you want some help with it, I wouldn't mind learning this script of yours.
Michael frowned at him.
That is the end of Chapter 25. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can follow the link at the top of my website, www.williameharlan.com, and purchase the full novel from Amazon in ebook format for $2.99 or as a paperback for $12.99. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for Chapter 26, The Second Pendulum.